Hey, everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This episode is brought to you in part by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app or searching for the right payments API, check out Braintree, and they say it's their V.0 SDK. So it's brand new and awesome, I think, is the idea. With one simple integration, your customers get every way to pay, meaning that it's PayPal APIs, but those same APIs then work with like Android Pay and Apple Pay and Bitcoin and all stuff with one API. Pretty darn cool. Check out Braintree.com/shoptalk. And then also the Content Strategy Summit. So it's literally contentstrategysummit.com. Long URL. Gets you to where you need to go. Content is probably the biggest pain point with web building. We have learned that in all of our years on Shop Talk Show. People are always like, they send me the content too late. Yada, yada. You've heard the deal. That's Content Strategy 101 stuff. You're going to learn about how to deal with content and your clients and all of the ways to do a good job with that. Check out contentstrategysummit.com. But you know what? We got a show to do here. Let's kick it off.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer. Labor Day. I've been drinking.
Well, that's how, you know, people write in sometimes and they say, how do you do it? You know, how do you get all that stuff done? Well, I'm sorry to say, it turns out you just work on Labor Day.
Work on Labor Day.
That is true.
Build a closet all weekend, and then you drink, and then you do a party.
Saran, right? I did it. I've listened to Code Newbie. Well, first of all, welcome to the show. I've got to give you the official welcome. A URL people can go to, one of the many that are associated with you, is a lovely one called bloggytunes.com, which has the greatest way ever for explaining how to say your name. So nobody can have any doubt on how it's said.
You know what's funny? People go to that and then they tell me, oh, I really love that page. It really taught me how to say your name. How do you say your name? And I have to tell them again anyway. So that's fun.
Okay. Well, not me.
Not you. You are different.
I practiced it. Not that I don't think it's particularly difficult anyway, to be fair. Although I could see a telemarketer being like, Sarah.
Sarah.
You know, I usually get Sharon. I also got Saffron once. Mm. Which was just, I don't know how that happened.
It's like an R in a font that looks real bad. Okay.
Maybe she was hungry. I don't know.
Could be. I want to talk about you and the stuff that you do a little bit, if that's okay.
Cool. That is okay.
Maybe like recent history. I know you through mm-hmm. Code Newbie because you very graciously invited me on to Code Newbie at the moment that it was a podcast. I'm episode like 40 something. So it's been around. Mm-hmm. It's been around a while. Did it start as the hashtag in a Twitter chat? And then you're like, this is really cool. I'm going to grow this thing up into a website and a blog and all that stuff. Or what was its birth?
That's exactly it. We started as a Twitter chat, and I started it because back when I was first learning to code, I spent the first couple months learning on my own. I did Treehouse and Code School and a bunch of those, you know, teach yourself type of programs. Sure. And I quit my job. I spent 12 hours a day doing nothing but coding, and I learned a lot, but it was really lonely and it was really frustrating. And when you get stuck, you're just stuck. And it was just sad. And when I finally applied to a programming school and got into boot camp, did that for a couple months, it was great because I had the learning and the structure and all that, but the real value that I got of it was the community. It was just, you know, sitting next to people who were just as passionate as I was and just as excited, but felt just as stupid as I did, you know, going through this process. And for me, that cost me $11,000, 6 months without a salary, which, you know, I'm very lucky to be able to do that. And a lot of people, I'd say most people, probably can't. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make it easier for people to find that support system without having to spend thousands of dollars and take 6 months off work. And so it started with just a Twitter chat. It was me tweeting questions for 1 hour every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern time, and me tweeting out questions using the hashtag. And so I'd say, you know, what language are you learning? What are you stuck on? What are you excited about? Where can, you know, where can we help you out? And people kept responding, and week after week, people kept showing up. And so we did that for, I think, almost a year, maybe like 10
wow.
months.
Wow.
And yeah, it went on for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, around the 10-month mark, what was happening was there were all these connections that were being made online, and the Twitter chat served as a conversation starter. It was like a little prompt, you know, and it started these conversations, but Twitter's not a very good medium for diving deep into a topic or really getting to ask someone about their journey and their life. And so, you know, I used to work at NPR. I thought I was going to be a journalist for a long time. And so I thought, you know, I like this radio thing. I like this storytelling interview thing. I've done that before. So a podcast felt like a really great way to solve the problem of taking, you know, the beginning, the nugget of a conversation, and then diving deep and really getting to explore it.
Sure. So they're very tied together. They have the same origin and goal. They're just different mediums.
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And it's still on Twitter, right? Like I see there's one coming up in a few days.
It.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Every Wednesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time. Yep.
Yeah, that's pretty great. And it's you know, I kind of feel like I've seen things like this come and go a little bit. Like there's mm-hmm. Designer Tuesdays or something.
Yep.
And then it's
a lot of companies do it too.
Do they? Like we're going
to. Yeah, like Buffer.
Do we
Buffer,
we promise to Buffer, be extra active during these hours or something?
Well, so Buffer, I think they actually have, it's called the Buffer Chat, and they'll use the hashtag Buffer Chat. And every week, I'm not sure how regularly they do it, but they have a date and a time where they do it, and they get lots of participants. And for them, it makes sense because they're a social media company, so they're, you know, doing social media. The way that we do it is generally different. A lot of people will do it as a way to interview someone on Twitter. So they'll have like a guest, and then they'll tweet questions at the guest, and then everyone can kind of chime in, which to me, I think Twitter's just not the right medium for an interview. I don't really think it works.
Like a real interview, you're saying? Like if you do well, we'll hire you?
Oh, no. I meant just like interviewing the person.
Oh.
So like what we do on the podcast, they would do via Twitter.
I see, yeah.
Which I'm not really a fan of that. But
maybe at the end you could storify it or something and make it a little.
That's true. You know. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's interesting. And then a few more tangential questions is that if I wanted to participate in this, and perhaps I will, it mm-hmm. seems pretty great. Like, is there a way to, you know, like if you at reply somebody, then you're not annoying. Annoying is a weird word because who knows what people are annoyed by specifically, but people don't see it that aren't following that person, right? It's kind of an opt-in
right.
following situation, but it doesn't quite work that way with hashtags, right? So if I was super, right. super active on Code Newbie time, I run the risk of a whole bunch of people seeing a whole bunch of tweets
yep.
that they're not. And is that just like whatever, you know?
Yeah, it's a whatever. So I've seen people warn their feed. So they'll say, by the way, it's, you know, Code Newbie time. So for the next hour, I'm going to be tweeting a lot about this one specific thing.
Yeah.
So watch out. Which, you know, I think is nice. You can also, you know, now on the Twitter app, at least you can mute people. So you can just mute them.
For an hour.
You can mute the hashtag. Right. For an hour or so. And then it's fine. When I first did it, I saw that I would like lose a lot of followers and then like gain a new set of followers. So I always kind of, you know, it was like a net zero for me. But at this point, everyone that I follow knows what's going down on Wednesdays at 9 o'clock. So they're okay with it.
Is it a little bit of hashtag brand awareness as well? Does it?
Yeah. Yeah. So. And that's the thing. Like a lot of people have said, oh, would you consider, you know, doing this in Slack or doing this in some other more private medium? And I don't really want to because you get to, like you said, it's brand awareness and it brings more people to the community. So it's, you know, it's free marketing for
yeah.
1 hour every week. And it's really great for new people to get to discover who we are and what we do.
Yeah, Slack seems weirdly private, but you know, I guess there's ups and downs in either one. Doesn't it seem like that web design and development culture is pretty Twitter heavy, so it seems like kind of
yeah.
the right place to do it. Although it is, you know, when you look at kind of global scope, it's so much smaller than Facebook, and I've heard in the past of companies that kind of were ignoring Facebook because they're so web design devy, and then be like, you know what, we should probably, you know, go over to Facebook too, because mm-hmm. you know, why not? And find a ton of people over there kind of ready to engage. So I'm not saying, hey, you should go over to Facebook too. You know, I don't have any stake in it because you're a year into this, the Twitter chat and doing great with it. But it's just kind of fun to think about that there's, you know, Twitter's mm-hmm. just one of many places where we can find yep. code newbies, not, you know, just the general word.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting stuff. So that's, you know, so your Bloggy Tunes, your Code Newbie, and Code Newbie has grown up tremendously. It's like there are a bunch of people even work on it now, right? It's like a...
Yeah. I think we have maybe 8 like volunteer people who, you know, give up a good amount of time on a weekly basis to help the community. So we started, apart from the podcast and the chats, we do have a Slack community. Mm-hmm. And that one we use more as, I think it's predominantly used as a place to share resources and to get unstuck very quickly. Like people are very, very active on it. I think we have about almost 1500 people in that community. Yeah. And it's been open for like 5 months. So
it's nice.
Yeah, it's nice. It's been really, really busy. And it's one of those things, for the reason that you mentioned earlier, I was a little uncomfortable with, because it is more private and the whole point is to be really accessible. And the other thing about a chat room is it's not, you know, unlike a discussion forum, there's really no concept of a moderator on Slack. There's no concept of like flagging and reporting messages on Slack. So one of my concerns as the community grows is just making sure that we're still being really inclusive and really friendly and really supportive. So that's kind of the interesting thing about that. But we also do these team project nights. So one of the big problems that I saw in our community was from people who are learning predominantly on their own and who are looking to get their first job, but one of the biggest differences between working on your own and working, you know, as a professional developer is you're in a dev team, right? You have to use, you know, Git and GitHub to do code reviews and pull requests. And you usually have some type of a project management system that you use, and you have feature stories. And there are these tools and processes that you don't get to experience when you're doing a Treehouse or a code school. And so one of the things that we started, I think 3 months ago, was we started doing these team projects. And so we have one for Ruby on Monday nights. We have one for JavaScript on Tuesday nights. We have one for Python on Thursday nights. We're about to start a language agnostic one that's just kind of code katas that we pick every 2 weeks. And then you work on it on your own. And then you come together to review solutions and see, you know, who did what. And so we have leaders for each of these teams. And they've been an incredible resource and just really, really great and really, really welcoming and beginner friendly. So, yeah, I've gotten a lot of help and I'm very lucky to have that.
Yeah, it's a fantastic looking site. So much great content there. Super, really well professionally done. So yeah, everybody, our audience, check out codenewbie.org and send people there who need the help. I like how the Slack thing is, the idea of getting mm-hmm. unstuck is so great, you know.
Yeah, that's the big one. And a lot of times it's something that once you get unstuck is very obvious, but you just can't see it. You know, you just really can't see it especially when you're frustrated and you've been working on it for a while, and having someone say, oh, you spelled that wrong or something simple. You get to really move forward a lot faster when you're doing it with other people.
Lovely. I wanted to ask you, when I was on, so Dave and I are hashtag podcasters, I guess.
We're basically like NPR, just similar to your background.
We're basically like NPR. I love that. That's great.
Very similar. Too self-deprecating or whatever, but we don't spend a whole lot of time leveling up our setup. It's, you know, right now as we're doing this, it's pretty much like exactly how we were doing it in episode 1, 180 mm-hmm. episodes later. So, and it works and it's great, but it's fun to occasionally experience other sound setups and equipment yeah. setups and stuff. And when I was on your podcast, it was a lot different. I mean, you, of course, you can't affect what equipment I have in front of me, but the software stack was very different, and it was really cool. And I thought maybe if you had a minute or were interested in sharing how that went, it's certainly a lot more advanced than just calling somebody up on Skype. So,
yeah, Yeah, sure. So we spent, I think, a month figuring that out. My husband and I, my husband's really into tech and does a lot of audio and video for fun on the side. And he's also done it as part of his job. So he's been like incredibly helpful in this process. But we tried, you know, we started by making a list of all the requirements that we had. So, you know, do we want, how important is the audio quality? How important is ease of use for the guest? How important is setting it up every time? And we looked at our requirements, and then we came up with all the different possible options. So we thought about doing Hangouts on air. We thought about doing Skype. We thought about doing what we ended up doing now, which is something called Mumble. And we looked at, you know, all the different ways and configurations that we could do it. And we ended up using Mumble, which is an open source, VoIP. And it's usually used for gamers. It's supposed to be really, really good for gamers, but it has a few features we really liked that made it very good for podcasting. So one of the things that we wanted to do is we wanted to make it really easy for everyone to record. And so when you start up Mumble, you have to start up the Mumble server to run Mumble, and you can just do it on your own laptop. When it's, you know, one command, it's very easy to set up. And then once you're in there, everyone has the same record button. So you get a lot of control over, you know, making sure if you wanted your guest to use a particular file format or, you know, software, like everyone's using the same thing. So you don't have to worry about that, you know, that variety and, you know, you minimize your variables that way. So you press the record button, and when you do, it had different file formats, and we usually export in .flac because it's lossless and it gives you half the file size as like a .wav, which is really nice. And it makes it, you know, faster to upload. And then the other thing we liked about it is that it comes in multi-stream. So when your guest is recording, they get their local feed for their voice, and then they get a separate stream for you coming through the internet. So even though you're recording from the software, it's still a local recording, which is really nice too. Yeah. So those were the, yeah. Go ahead.
No, just it's a nice way to go. And you're not subject then to something like Skype being the bottleneck or going down
exactly
or something, right? But you are then
exactly
you're responsible for your own server, which hopefully is better.
Right, yeah, and our server is pretty good. And we also, you know, so when we do it, I don't run the server off of my laptop. I run it off of my husband's, and then he's connected directly to the internet. So we feel very secure with that setup after having tried it a couple times. And then the other thing that we really like about Mumble is it has very granular control of your audio settings. And it took us a while to get that setting right because the default settings are made for video games. And when you're, you know, playing a game with a bunch of people and you need to talk to each other, you don't really care about the audio quality. You care about making sure that there are no packets lost. You care about making sure you hear everything as quickly as possible. There's no delays. So it's not optimized for audio quality. So we had to go in and learn about the settings and figure out, you know, what buttons need to go where and what needs to be 100% and whatever it is to make sure that we're optimizing for sound. So it took a while to, you know, have the right configurations, but now that we do, it's a relatively easy process. And the other thing that we learned, and I'd love to hear your feedback actually, Chris, on this, is we knew that it was, honestly, it's quite a setup for us to do on our end, but we wanted it to not be a burden for the guest. So we tell them, you know, just download Mumble, don't touch it, we'll walk through it together. And then we'll do a video call, and then we'll tell you, you know, push this button. And it, you know, it takes a couple minutes, but
The idea is that it's no big deal. Yeah, and I remember going through it, and it was fine. It was, you know, it's unfamiliar software, but it's like no big deal. And you tell me exactly what to press, and we press it, and on we go. That actually might be, you know, it's I would say it's more, it's, you know, you did, there's a minor sacrifice in that, you know, download this unfamiliar software and run it on your machine. But you might, you know, there might be the occasional guest. I mean, we haven't had a ton of trouble with this, but, you know, not everybody loves Skype, you know, or they kind of, you know, it's been a million years since they've opened up Skype. You know, I feel like most people these days use Skype only for these very specific situations, like when somebody asks them to please use it, at least in the circles we run in. It's not particularly common, but maybe more common at Microsoft, huh? Because you own it, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. I definitely do more Skyping now that I'm at Microsoft. That's for sure. But yeah, that was the one thing that we were worried about, is we weren't sure the resistance we'd get from asking people to download software they'd never heard of before. But, you know, in the 52 episodes that we've done, we've never had a complaint. So far it's, you know, it hasn't been a problem.
Well, that's the proof's in the pudding there then, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what do you think, Dave? Mumble?
I'll take a look at it in my spare time. I think it's actually very clever to kind of, you know, we get hooked to these tools, these tools that we're kind of used to using. And I think it's very clever to kind of look at, like, video. What do video gamers use to broadcast and kind of group record all their shenanigans? Which
all their shenanigans.
I mean, and that happens at scale every day, you know, for multiple hours at a time. So I think it's very clever to kind of, I don't know, borrow from that community to do a web podcast.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We were looking at solutions that use the Opus codec, because that's, you know, the best one, especially for speech and music transition over the internet. And Skype uses Opus, and so did Mumble. So that's how we came across it, was just looking at, like, what's the best codec, what uses the best codec, and then trying those out. And then we realized that, oh, gamers use this. That makes us feel better because, you know, it's probably tried and tested. And then we tried it ourselves, and it's worked very well for us.
Fantastic. I'm going to do a quick sponsor spot, and then we'll jump into some Q&A and just some more. We'll just chat. We'll just keep chatting. That's what we do here on Chop Talk Show. One of our sponsors is, I feel like if we really wanted to be NPR, Dave, or get this network thing going, we definitely need to get some ad backbeat stuff. You know,
all right, I'll go get the banjo.
You know, when they do the ads, it's good. You're going to get in the ukulele, Dave? Anyway, so it's brought to you by the Content Strategy Summit. It's an Environments for Humans. It's one of the online summits, meaning that you can attend it from anywhere in the world. You just need an internet. You need some internet and a screen to watch it with. Here it comes. As they write, content is the biggest pain point with web building. Learn how to level up with content strategy by taking 2 days, and those 2 days are September 21st and September 22nd, so it's coming up this fall. Taking 2 days with industry's best trainers without leaving the office, because, you know, you can do it from a couch, you can do it from a chair, you can do it from the ground if you want to. You can kind of do anything you want, because it's an online conference all about content. Pretty lovely. They also say, life happens. That's why we include full access to recordings of each session in addition to copies of the presenter's slides and event recordings. So, you know, I've done this before. You can log back into the system they use to attend this conference and, like, scrub through the talk. It's like a fully interactive thing. And as you scrub through it, even the, like, chat room scrubs, you know, like who said what when, that comes with it. It's, like, pretty cool interactive thing. So if you have to step out for lunch and miss one, or you have a meeting and you have to miss one, no problem, because you can go back and watch it. You really, really liked one. There's some code in one you wanted to copy. No problem. You can go back in time and watch it. So pretty great. No travel, no restaurants, no hotel room, no flights, all that stuff, because you can attend it from anywhere. That's contentstrategysummit.com. Let's do some questions. Thanks, Dave, for the faraway banjo music.
That's all I got. All right, question number one. Here we go. Jay Wilbon writes in, Saran, you're involved in so many things every week. You're on a lot of podcasts I listen to, and you run Code Newbies, which I love and I'm a part of. I have to know, how are you keeping your life balanced? What tools do you use to manage everything? Hey, that's sort of a personal question, but how do you do the things you do? What enables you to do so much?
Oh, balance. That's a fun word. I don't know if I'm very good at balancing things. I mean, so the whole work-life balance conversation, which, you know, I think is a part of that question, is one that I don't really like personally, because I'm not a hobby person. You know, I don't do things just for the sake of it. Everything that I do, I want to feel like it has a bigger purpose than just what happens in the moment. So a lot of my work is my life, because I really like the work that I get to do. And so if I'm not working, you know, I work full time at Microsoft. If I'm not doing that, then I'm spending almost all of my time at Code Newbie by choice, because that's what I really love to do. That's what I'm passionate about. So I don't think I have the kind of balance that a lot of other people look for and think about, but I'm very happy with the way I do things.
I like that.
I spend exactly 1/3 of my time rock climbing, 1/3 of my time in Ruby, and 1 time eating quinoa or whatever.
I can't do that
anymore. Right. That's just not who I am. Right, exactly. But for tools, I think that there are a couple of things. So I use the crap out of my calendar. I section off specific times. Like, I have a whole calendar called tasks. And if there's a thing that I just need to sit down and do, I'll block it off as an event in my calendar. And once I started doing that, I definitely got a lot more productive and a lot more efficient in how I use my time.
Do you block off like a morning, or do you block off like an hour? Like, how do you do big blocks or little blocks?
I hate the mornings.
No mornings.
Mornings are the worst. I'm not a morning person. I feel like I should be, but I don't want to be. And I don't understand why everyone's obsessed with waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I would like to wake up at 9 or 10, and then I'll stay up until like 1 or 2 a.m. That's how I like to do things.
Yeah.
So most of my time blocking are in the evenings. And then on the weekends, I almost always have a morning call at either 10 a.m. or 11 a.m. And I do that on purpose to force me to get my day started. Otherwise, I'll just sleep in until noon. And then most of my core, like, hard thinking activities happen in the afternoon or evening.
Yeah. Wow. Very nice. I don't know that I have any particular plan either with the thing. Dave's probably has to be a little bit more regimented these days with the second one on the way and all that. I'm sure that.
Ooh.
You learn real quick.
I heard a Cameron Mall talk once that where he addressed this in a very eloquent way, I feel like, because he's in a similar situation with a big family and lots to do. He said that I don't do balance, I do prioritization. So there's...
Ooh, I like that.
Isn't it good? Maybe I can dig up a link to the talk where he says that it's not, you know, it's not balance. It's that these things are the most important things in my life. So they happen first, and then, you know, it kind of goes down the stack. And I think you could get pretty detailed about that. In that certain things are pretty important and certain things are like medium important. And then you can probably factor into that algorithm time a bit. So if there's, you know, medium important things that have been neglected for a long time, they sort of all of a sudden become slightly more important because.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I love this. I think there needs to be like an equation for this. Because this makes a lot of sense.
At least as an equation that we could, like a fake equation to help explain the concept. Because it's not like I'm going to actually consult the equation when I'm deciding something to do.
Right. It's just, this is how generally I think about things. No, you're totally right. So, you know, to me, my priorities are my job, code newbie, and then kind of everything else happens somewhat later. And you're right. The longer I wait to do one thing, the more it suddenly becomes important, right? So my mom is in Maryland. I'm in the New York City area. And so if I haven't seen her in, you know, months, all of a sudden that becomes an urgent thing that needs to be fixed, you know, soon. So yeah, I really like that formula, that way of thinking.
Because that way you actually have bandwidth for quite a few more things, not just three post-it notes on your desk. It's it's just whatever needs priority.
I
like that in theory. I'm sure moms and dads out there will empathize, but when you have kids, it's this interesting thing. And I'm gonna curse here, but your bullshit meter is like at zero, and it's this kind of cool kind of decision crucible you get through having dependents, and that could, I guess, go for if you have a parent that you're taking care of or something like that, but you're like, I'm not, nope, I don't care about that, because it's like it doesn't even fall on the priority list, because it's just there's such a, you know, sort of a discrepancy between what somebody needs in a GitHub issue and what you need to do at your house. So it's kind of nice, but you know, you do have a little less time than, you know, I can't stay up till 2 a.m. anymore having fun. But
what time do you wake up in the morning?
Oh, goodness gracious. Anywhere. It's a surprise. My son likes the surprises. Anywhere from 5:30 to 7.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah. Hey, whatever. Well, let's talk. The biggest problem I'm experiencing now is he comes into the bed at the middle of the night, and then he, like, karate kicks my face, and so I actually get pushed out of the bed to the couch. So that's the current experience at the moment. So thank you.
The karate kick alone sounds painful, but then it's on your face.
Yeah, he like just burrows with the toenails right into your face. And so, hey, but it's, I do like that prioritization thing, but,
Yeah, but besides the calendar, another tool that I love is Trello. And I use Trello for a lot of things. I use it for organizing my own personal to-dos. I use it for everything that we do with Code Newbie. And we actually use it to build our newsletter. I don't know if you guys saw the blog post that Changelog did some time ago. It may have been like a year or two ago. I'm not sure. But they use the Trello board to organize and manage their content for their newsletter. And then they wrote a gem or a script that, you know, turns that into
it actually makes the HTML for the newsletter. Like,
it makes the HTML and it sends it off to MailChimp. So we saw that blog and we wrote a Ruby gem for it. So now, you know, on our website, if you go to like admin/newsletter generator and you press the button, it'll pull all the stuff from Trello. It'll organize it in the right way. It'll, you know, make the index.html. It'll zip it and then it'll ship it off to MailChimp for us. So Trello is awesome and it's been incredibly helpful in a lot of organization stuff.
That's cool. I saw, I'm about to start using a thing that's a copy perhaps, but it makes it look Trello-like, but it's GitHub issues.
You know,
like it
turns like
GitHub issues into that. I can't remember.
Hubboard?
What's that?
Hubboard? Hubboard? Or Waffle.io?
Yeah, maybe.
Waffle. I hope it's Waffle.io. That's
Hubboard.
Awesome.
Hubboard.
Oh yeah, maybe it is.
I did Hubboard.
I see it. Yeah,
I did Hubboard this week. I like it. It is very. It fills up your. it fills up your issues very quickly. I don't know if it's exactly right for me, but
You know what? I don't know that it is this one. Anyway, we'll talk about it later if I can find the different one I use. It's different than this. Let's do some more questions because we have a whole bunch of them to get through. So,
yeah,
Andrew Bittinger writes in, how well should you know JavaScript frameworks before you consider yourself a good front-end developer? Pretty wide-ended question. And he also goes on to ask, at what point would you consider yourself a senior developer? So I guess first he wants to know, how do you know if you're good or not, which is a little arbitrary, but senior isn't it's arbitrary still, but not totally arbitrary because it can be part of your job title, right?
That's true. I think that you're senior when you can get paid for a title that has senior in it.
Sure. And that's legit.
That's really what it is. That's really what it is. Because, you know, I know so many people who have been coding for, you know, for not that long and getting positions with certain titles that may be a little surprising. And then I know people who've been coding for longer and still think they're a junior. So, you know, I really wish there was a more agreed upon standardized system where we can say, you know, 2 years, you must have explored these 10 problems and coded in these 3 languages. Mm-hmm. At this point, you are now.
Do you really want that though?
Mid-level. I do. I think that the execution of that would be awful and terrible. But if there was a way in the ideal world where everyone could be happy with these standards and I can just look to them and know that from, you know, if I do these things and I'm here, I'd really like that.
I suppose. Like,
you wouldn't like
no,
it?
If there was a bar exam, and, you know, because the bar is largely regarded as pretty good, right? And then if you pass it, you're lawyer like, and there is no such, you know,
you're lawyer like, lawyer esque. Yes.
If you went through some kind of certification like that, would you consider yourself a Microsoft certified professional developer?
We do have those things. That is a good point. But, you know, I think that specifically for web development, it's really hard because everything changes all the time. And the tools change, the things that people are using change, the needs of the organizations that are using them change. So it's too fast and too fluid for any kind of certification process to really make any sense. But, you know, it's hard, and this is something we come up with a lot in the Code Newbie community, it's really hard to gauge where you are if you're just starting out. And that's why we do these team projects, because when you're working alongside someone else, you get to see the things you know, and you get to see the things that maybe you thought you knew, but you really had no idea. You get to kind of, you know, evaluate yourself based on how other people react to you, and you either playing more of the student or more of the teacher. So at work, you know, I learned front end stuff primarily on my own, just from a lot of angry nights with CSS. And I didn't realize how much I learned and figure out until I had two more junior people on my team. And we had to take this mock-up I made in Sketch, and we had to slice it up and figure out, you know, where everything was going to go and what styles we're going to use. And as I was explaining things, I was like, holy crap, I know this. I didn't realize, you know, how much was in there. So I think that rather than figuring out, you know, what are the standards that I need to meet, I think the more people you work with and the more people you work with in terms of the difference in experience and background and language, I think you'll get a better sense of your strengths and weaknesses, and you'll be able to improve a lot faster.
That's great. They don't exist because they're completely garbage. Probably, I mean, we've probably made fun of job titles in the past on this show, but largely the reason that they exist, I would think. Well, I mean, let's say you put yourself in the position of you're the boss or something at somewhere that employs like 10 JavaScript developers, let's say. You probably pay them slightly differently based on their skills. Let's say one of them's been there for 5 years and they're amazing and they head up all the projects and they, you know, are very patient with new people and are great with clients too. And they're just clearly like just an amazing asset developer at your company. It may be nice to call them senior and then have some pay scale that's commensurate with that. And that maybe sets up some kind of expectation that when you hire someone brand new, and let's say they're good too, but they haven't, you know, kind of shown that they're as good as the person that's been around for 5 years, that they're not, you know, they're junior or just they don't have one. I think that's generally the middle one is junior or nothing and then senior, right? Generally. And maybe that makes sense for your company. Yeah. And that having that title applied to it helps with like the feelings at the company. It helps with expectations, and I don't know. It becomes kind of an event when you become senior, and I don't know. It just doesn't bother me. It seems very practical to me.
For me, it seems like senior implies you have some sort of junior tied to you, soul bound to you. just that you would be in the position where you would have to advise junior people on what to do. I sort of wish we had that, like, 16th century level of apprenticeship here in our industry, but we kind of don't. But it would be really cool, I think, if we did.
We could say years to Andrew, though. I would suspect that to get a fair senior developer title, that you're probably looking at spending years in that task. I would think it would be maybe somebody would bestow it upon you earlier or longer than that, but well, it can't be longer than years, but, you know, 2 to 5 years seems reasonable to me, I would think.
And it's quite possible the senior developer does not need to ask if they're a senior developer. They simply climb the mountain and gaze.
Yeah, Coraline Ada Emke gave a talk at RailsConf last year on apprenticeships, and it was exactly that. It was looking back and, you know, going to the old school style of apprenticeships where you are studying under a master for, I think it was many years, honing your craft and learning, and then eventually, you know, getting your own, I guess, your own job, and maybe eventually becoming a master. And, you know, I don't know how feasible that is in our community, but I'm definitely excited to see more junior level positions open up. And I think that's just, you know, a reaction to the market. And I think that there's a lot more code newbies out there than there were. There are a lot more specifically career changers, right? People like me who were doing something different and found code and fell in love with it and decided to pursue it as a career. And so, you know, I get emails all the time for people asking, you know, do you know about any apprenticeships? Do you know about any internships? And there aren't that many that are available for people who are not, you know, in school or in college. But I'm hoping that'll change. I'm hoping that we start to see more apprenticeships and more junior level positions. And then in that case, you're totally right. A senior developer makes a lot of sense because you do have a junior.
Because I mean, there's a lot of money going into hack schools or code schools, you know, and they are somewhat unaccredited, but I think people are having a good experience in them. I'm not shutting them down. I think they're kind of the best way to learn at the right now. But, you know, what if the alternative was you started working for a company, you know, and they said, you really want to learn this code thing, huh? Well, kid, get scrub the toilets or something, you know, what does that? I don't know. Just, I guess. Could we make that happen? And would that equal something, I guess, like a code school? I don't know.
Liam Duckworth writes in, how can I get past the, and this is very related, so we can, you know, we can get through it, get past to the initial inexperience stigma, the stigma being from someone who's hiring somebody. Liam says, I am extremely talented straight out of college, yet it's hard to get a job because I have no experience. So it's kind of loaded. There's not very many words in that question, but there's some clues, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there are lots. I mean, the great thing about coding is you can do it from anywhere. You don't need someone's permission to get that experience. There's lots of open source projects that you can find, you can contribute to. OpenHatch, I think .org, is a really great resource, and they're really trying to get more people involved in open source, so definitely check that out. In December, there's going to be 24 pull requests, which is a thing that Andrew Nesbitt in the UK, he's an absolutely amazing guy. He started this program to get people to want to contribute to open source, and he would do it, you know, as part of like a Christmas theme kind of thing. And so the idea is make a pull request every day. Not everyone does it, and it's perfectly fine if you don't, but there are a lot of ways to get that experience without necessarily getting a full-time job, and things you can do on nights and weekends, things you could do during your lunch break that you can use to develop your own skills. I think the other part of it is when you are pitching, I would think about what are the things that make you different. And I think this might apply more to career changers than necessarily college grads, but a lot of the people who are transitioning into a tech career come from very interesting backgrounds. And I find that a lot of people are ashamed of that, and they're very self-conscious about, you know, well, I haven't been coding since I was 12. I've been doing this for a year. But they've been doing marketing for 10 years, or they were a dance teacher for 5, or they were all these other interesting things. And what I tell them is to find a way to bring that into your coding and to play that up and to show the skills that you have and the asset that you are, because you come with a very different perspective than the other people on the team that might all have CS degrees. So I think there are ways that you can look at your perceived weaknesses and make them into strengths.
Yeah, that's great. So lots of stuff there. The sentence, I am extremely talented straight out of college. I think there's stuff there that's both, I think there needs to be a combo of some confidence, because it's great that you have that, because you clearly do, because you wouldn't, you know, you don't want to walk into, you know, your head hanging down into an interview saying like, oh, I don't have any experience, but please let me work here kind of thing, because that's no good, you know. Mm-hmm. You want somebody with their head held high saying like, look at my work, this is what I can do, please, I can do good things for your company, let me work here. To write us a sentence that says like, I'm basically amazing, so I can't believe that these companies aren't hiring me. Like, it's hard to unpack this because I've never met you, Liam. We haven't shook hands. I can't get a sense of your personality through one sentence, but it's like, it seems like there's a little of both happening here, and I would maybe watch that a little bit. You know, I would be turned off by somebody who's, you know, sent me an email or applied for a job and just bragged or just, you know, came across as cocky in some way. Like, that's just a turn. That doesn't usually work particularly well in this industry. And I'm not alone in that. Probably we, or that's kind of like, yeah, you know, because are you that amazing? You mm-hmm. did just graduate college, so you could have some amazing natural talent or whatever, but you know, you're probably, you know, you probably could use some growing up, some job stuff happening, you know? I don't know if I would mm-hmm. hand out my how amazing I am thing when you haven't worked anywhere yet. Because amazingness comes with work in some case, at least if that's what you're looking to be hired to do. Anyway, I was kind of floundering there for a minute, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have a friend like that, very talented designer, was very bad with people, and it was very rough for employment. So I'm not saying I'm not projecting anything, but it's a real thing. It's a real
there
thing.
Is, but what is experience too? What is it? What is it? It's building websites, right? It's like here, you know, you go in and you say, look at, here's a bunch of the things that I've built. You know, maybe the who paid you to build that section is a little light or something, but I think you can have a full portfolio. You can have a good looking resume, without just because you haven't worked for, you know, Geico.com or something, you know, that's like a missing section on your resume. If you have incredible other work, I think you'll still kind of be okay. So I've always kind of, it's pet peeve territory for someone to be like, oh, I wish I could build my portfolio, but I can't possibly do that until someone gives me the chance to do that.
I was along the lines of places to contribute. I saw a thing this weekend. Your first PR on Twitter is by Charlotte Is. I don't know Charlotte's last name, but it's basically like opportunities, like low hanging fruit to make pull requests and to get experience like getting in and out of repos and helping people out. So. I don't know of any company that would shy away from a really thoughtful GitHub account. And I'm not mm-hmm. saying go through and just like blanket, I don't know, fix somebody's bower. That's not what we're talking about. But like, or like optimize everybody's for loops. Don't do that. What you want to do is just be, you know, like find something you're interested in. That's the whole point of like, open source, if you have the time for it.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Don't we have a, let's see, what are we, 46 minutes into this? I should probably do another sponsor quick. Remember, we mentioned at the top of the show that Braintree was one of our sponsors. They're pretty cool. I've mentioned in the past that we're looking at moving to them on CodePen. It's just, you know, it's taking us some time to get there. We're a very small team, but we're moving to them because the API is so nice, and it's nice compared to using just kind of the native PayPal APIs. Maybe those will get better someday, but it's kind of like, why bother? Why don't you just use the Braintree ones, which are already nice, which then means that you get PayPal integration, but you get like at the same moment that you get PayPal integration, you get like Android Pay and Apple Pay and Bitcoin and a handful of other ones, all through using the same API, which is pretty cool. They say simple, secure payments. You can integrate in minutes. Developers, we got you. Don't worry about taking days to integrate payments with Braintree. It's done in minutes. Don't have time? Give them a call, and they'll even handle integration for you and walk you through it, which is kind of incredible. But I did go to their about page, and there's kind of a lot of people that work there, so I don't doubt it. Their SDK comes in .NET, Node, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby, you know, all of the languages of the web, I'd say. Lots of docs, very clear, very nice website, very easy to integrate. So check out braintree.com/shoptalk.
If you're going to want to support PayPal, and you do.
Yeah, you just kind of do, because a lot of people want.
You're going to want this. Yeah. You want this codes. You want their codes. Get their codes.
Oh, this one.
Go download their codes.
There's what? One came in 7 minutes ago here, hot off the presses. This is the most hot off the presses question that's ever been asked on Shop Talk. Ron, can you explain how you came up with the rebase dance? And second question, what's the rebase dance?
I know exactly who this is too. Hi, Jay. Okay, so for the team projects that I talked about, one of the big parts is you have to know Git, and you have to know how to use Git. And so I started doing these. They're supposed to be an hour, but they ended up going on for about 2 hours. These interactive sessions where I'd do a Google Hangout. There'd be, you know, 10 other people in the session. And it's very, very interactive. And I'd walk them through my process for, you know, first you take a feature card, then you make a feature branch, and then you do some stuff, and then you add, and then you commit. And we went through the whole flow all the way from making up all the way to making a pull request and making a comment and then merging it in. And one of the last things that I would talk about if we had time was rebasing. And so to explain rebase, I would do a thing that is apparently now known as the rebase dance, where where I would show, you know, you have like your master branch and you're branching off. And then when you're rebasing, it's like you're taking all the stuff on master and then you're committing it. And then you're basically like putting it right under your feature branch as if it was there the whole time. And so that movement that I would make with my arms, which no one can see right now, that is the rebase dance.
That's great. Yeah. That actually helps me understand it a little bit more too. You take this whole chunk and kind of move it. To me, it's just the button I press when I don't want to see the merge commit anymore because it looks so gross or whatever in the timeline. But it's kind of, it kind of moves a whole chunk over to another area, and thus the merge didn't need to happen. Right. Because it's, I don't know. What I don't know about rebasing is when it's dangerous, because I think it is sometimes, right? But I just, I think it's not, you know, otherwise, why is it a separate action? You know, I don't know.
Oh, that's a good point.
I think it, it can kind of explode. Like, you can get into.
Yeah, but when?
Just
and how?
like if you had like, a let's say you got some from master and then you committed some and then you tried to put into master but then it got kicked back out because it wasn't right, and then you like the master's up again, and I mean in theory it should all work, right? Like it should, you should just be able to like what, do the dance, land the planes, right? But I'm like, I don't know if I'm doing the dance right, but I'm doing a dance right now. It's very snaky and
it is. It is very
simple. All right.
Full shift.
I think it is possible to kind of like.
It just never comes up in my things. Simple world where I just, it's like, it's usually master and one branch, and they dance, they go back and forth, and that's about it. It's not like branches of branches of branches of branches and people.
Well, and that's like if you needed a branch to, like if you needed the comment branch to land your feature comment to land your feature blog post branch or something, you know, like, or vice versa, you kind of get into like needing to branch off of another branch.
Yeah, it's gonna happen to me tomorrow because I know that I have to branch a branch and
so I think it starts getting, but that's just complexity, you know. So I just created two branches that land like months from each other.
Complexity.
It's just complexity. It's going to be hard. But I just created two branches that are going to land like months from each other. And I'm like already crying about how how hard it's going to be. But anyway.
Pulling from master.
Okay, you can do it. We believe in you.
Yeah. What? We believe in you. Also, I'm not afraid to force push. I am not afraid. I will force it up.
Froy wrote in with a question, Dave. Do you want to see what's up with this one?
Yeah, here we go. Froy writes in, I started teaching myself web development at the beginning of the year, and I love it! Exclamation point. I started a challenge for myself. The challenge is to recreate 30 sites that need a responsive design and newer look. For these redacted sites, I am using surge.sh. Oh, recreated. Sorry, not redacted. For these recreated sites, I am using surge.sh to deploy the static pages. My question is, are there any legal ramifications for publishing a copy of the site's information online? Oh, should I have an alert on the Surge site that lets users know that this is a copy of somename.com?
Oh man, that's like a legal question. I would guess that there's probably a problem with that. And at the very least, to not confuse users, I would put something on there that says this is a replica of this other thing. But I would guess there's a legal issue with that. But I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have a definitive answer.
I agree. I would say that it's even if it's not illegal, it's in bad form to just toss up a site on the web that is the same exact content of some other site that you've redesigned without saying somewhere clearly on it, this is a practice thing for me, you know?
Right. And hopefully you're not, I mean, I don't know what these sites are, but if they're like e-commerce sites, hopefully you're not like actually accepting, you know, purchases and things like that.
Yeah.
So I would, at the very least, I would have something there that says, you know, I'm learning to code. This is my project, you know, point them to a blog post or a repo where they can see all the other work and really use it as a promo tool for you. But I'd be very clear not to confuse people.
I agree.
And it might work double duty if you do tell people, you know, like if your design is, oh, look at how good of a designer is. I've redesigned the site and it's way better now. You might as well have a bar that says, hey, this is just me playing around. Go check out my other sites that I've done at my portfolio. It seems like why not? Why might as well?
Definitely. Maybe those sites will pay you to use your code. Maybe.
Also, surge.sh looks really cool. I've never seen it before, but yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't either. I'm on it right now. Looks really interesting.
I would also turn on robots.txt to block everything so that you don't steal SEO. That's important, too. Because if you steal their SEO, they're going to get mad.
Good point. Adam Norris writes in, actually, this is an audio one. Should I wait for a minute, Dave, or do you already have it pulled up? Or?
Oh, I can. Let me. Yeah, set it up. Set it up real friendly.
Adam Norris writes in.
Can you spell Adam Norris?
No, I won't do that to you, Dave. This will be our last one, and then we'll wrap it up a little bit. Looks like Adam is a part-time freelancer. Started to get recently landed a full-time job, and has having some
congratulations.
Some pain though, literal pain in his wrist.
Literal pain.
Pain. Let's see.
Sorry, I told Siri to call me Batman one time, and so I just got an email from Batman. This is wonderful. All right, let me play. I'm about to play the audio here. Here we go.
Hey, Chris and Dave. After a period of part-time freelancing, I've recently landed a full-time front-end developer job for a small digital agency. However, after a few weeks of working 9-to-5 with a keyboard and mouse, I started to get some pains in my wrist and arm. Thinking it sounded like the beginnings of RSI, I quickly switched to using a vertical mouse and using wrist supports for both the keyboard and mouse, along with getting medication from a doctor. As this is the beginning of my career, I'm really worried about this turning into a long-term problem. I want to do everything I can to stop it getting any worse. I just wondered if you guys could offer any advice to people suffering from similar problems, or if you have had any personal experience with this or any other type of work-based injury. Thanks, Adam.
All right, so Adam just got a new job, new career, and his wrists are starting to kind of, I know the feeling, but get the aches and shakes. So, anyone have any experience with that?
Well, I have a little, but do you, Saran?
I personally have not. I know that one of my coworkers who I don't remember if he was already experienced the pain or if it was more preventative, but he would use like a computer glove that has that, you know, that like pouchy area in your palms. And it was really funny because I would mostly see him wearing it, and so I just kind of thought his palms were like crazy fat. And then he would take them off, and I'm like, "You have normal hands," and it totally threw me off every single time. But it's nice because you don't have to move your hand quite as much to type, and it looked very, very comfortable. So that's one thing that I might look into. I'm trying to find out. I think if you search like computer glove typing, you should see some options.
That's interesting.
You haven't seen that before?
No, not the fat palm.
Oh,
no,
it's the fat palm. That should be the name of it. Okay, new company idea, Fat Palm.
Yeah, it would be easy to remember anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I had this when I first moved out to Portland. Just, I don't know, that was just, it's random. It doesn't have anything to do with the city. It's just a time in my life. I started getting it really bad, the RSI thing, and I bought a book on it. I bought a book called It's Not Carpal Tunnel Syndrome with an exclamation point on it that was kind of like, it's usually not in our industry carpal tunnel. It's usually RSI, which I think that the world has kind of won that pedantic battle, or I don't think it's pedantic. I think it's just people's understanding of it. RSI meaning repetitive stress injury. It's a lot more common when it has to do with typing and mouse moving and stuff, I think. Yeah, and I got it really bad, and I was really worried because it does kind of seem like I literally can't keep doing this. I can't because it'll just destroy my hand. What do you do then? You know, like, am I going to become do I have to change careers here or what? And my solution was to get a wrist thing. And it totally didn't work. Like a wrist guard thing. So I was like, I don't know if those things work, but it wasn't a fat palm. It was just a, I was just self-diagnosing. Nobody told me to do this. I was just like, I don't know, my wrist kind of hurts, so I'll put a wrist thing on it. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. But that didn't work at all. But what did work was the split keyboard. And I have a Microsoft keyboard in front of me right now. They sell the best one ever, I think.
The Sculpt.
Is it the ergonomic? Well, I have the Sculpt. Microsoft I also Sculpt have the ergonomic. Another one, the just the ergonomic.
Clicky or low profile?
The big fat one I have, okay. Which is, yeah, clicky. I have them both, though. I try to stay flush in these keyboards because this is the magic answer for me.
The split
keyboard. If I have the split keyboard, I'm fine. It literally solved the problem entirely. It's been like basically in remission, I guess, for 6 or 7 years now. The split keyboard was the magical thing. The vertical mouse that Adam says he has. So what did he say? It sounded like he switched to a vertical mouse and wrist supports. He didn't say the split keyboard though, so I would check that out. Maybe it worked for me, and definitely support. Ask your actual doctor and not pot. Right.
Before you go out and buy all this stuff, right. Talk to a doctor. Yeah.
Yeah, I've spent about $600 in keyboards this year.
Oh, I think, Dave.
Oh, wow.
Just like
write it off, Dave. Write it off.
Well, write it off. Total write off, but jackpot. But it's the Sculpt. I like the like classic Mackie kind of. Microsoft has a designer one they use on the PC, but man, my wrists, I'll start to feel it, and where I especially feel it is if I did something like manual, like yard work or something all weekend, and like I go to work Monday and it's like my hands are like breaking from the inside. That's what it feels like. It's brutal. But this Sculpt keyboard is just wonderful, and it's a little weird because you have to like redo your typing. Like I hit the B key from the wrong hand apparently, but it makes a world of difference in how you feel at the end of the day. And my special trick, here's my trick, insider hot tip, trackpads, man, don't mess with mouses are way too much energy. You just use trackpads and it's really dumb. Like get one of those.
I used to use
ones.
The trackball forever. Oh. For 10 years I'd rock the ball, and the reason I switched is because it started to become a pain in the butt to bring everywhere. So I was like, I'm actually going to train myself to just use a regular mouse because it just was too weird. Anyway, the trackball was kind of neither good or bad for the RSI.
I love the trackpad. It's the dumbest course.
You don't even have a mouse at all?
No.
You just start all trackpad?
Oh, yeah, like when I can be. Some,
I was just at an Apple store, and that's what they put next to all the displays now. They don't put the mouse out. They just put the pads.
Why would you?
It looks cool.
Mice. Yeah, let me flash back to 1980 when that was cool. Mouse.
Dave. Judgy. Yeah.
Well.
Just kidding.
Had a couple beers. This is how I feel. These are my true feelings.
It's Labor Day. So let's wrap this thing up. We've been going on a bit long. Yeah, there's stuff. Dave does stuff.
Yeah, I got to get back to the house, eat a pizza. Saran, thank you so much for coming on the show. If people aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that? And then what's one thing you'd like to plug before you leave today?
Sure, you can totally give me money. So we set up our Patreon account relatively recently, a couple weeks ago. So if you go to patreon.com/codenewbie, that's where you can donate and support what we're doing. And one thing I want to plug, I think I just want to plug the website. If you go on codenewbie.org, you get to see all the different things that we're doing. You can take a look at the team projects, the awesome blog posts that different people write on what they're learning and what kind of code they're excited about. And you can find out about the podcast and all that stuff there. So definitely check out the site and check out patreon.com/codenewbie.
Yeah, it looks like codenewbie.com/support will get you there too, in case you can't spell Patreon because there's two vowels next to each other and it's weird.
That is true.
Thanks for being on. I should say that we had somebody wrote in that said, what was it? Byron Sampira wrote in and he said he's graduating with a computer science degree in the next year and has a strong interest in working at Node.js, but wherever he lives, there's not a lot of jobs in that. He's wondering if it's worth relocating to pursue a career in that technology. I don't mean to dwell on this too long, but I would say, Byron, I think it's always, if you can, it's always nice to relocate, because I've done it a couple of times in my life, and I look back on it fondly, being like, it was nice. It was nice to up and move and do something new and give me more perspective on, you know, just feel fresh, get that new city smell, you know? So if you can do it, I'd say do it. That's pretty great. And especially if you can do it and do something good for your career. And it just so happens that we have kind of the job for you potentially. We should mention that Shop Talk, if you don't like your job, you're looking for a job, or you're looking to hire, you can always go to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and look for a bunch of jobs there. One of the jobs there is at a place called Code Koalas, which is just the greatest name ever, right?
That's such a great name.
Isn't it?
Oh my goodness.
Why not? It looks like a pretty cool company, and you probably would have to relocate to do it. It's in Kansas City. So I assume you don't live there, because I just don't know anybody that does, you know. But I bet it's like I live in Milwaukee, you know. No, I never run into people that live here either. It's just one of those places. But I would think, you know, you could do this thing, start over in a new place that's probably not like overly expensive and stuff, and look at what they want, a bonus skill, Node.js. Like if you rolled in there and you knew all the stuff that you already knew, all the front end stuff, and then said, I'm actually actively interested in pursuing Node.js stuff, they'd probably be very interested in talking to you. And this goes for everybody out there too. So Code Koalas is in Kansas City, Missouri, which is not, it's weird that it's not in Kansas, but that's how Kansas City rolls. And they're looking for front end and back end developers. So they just need people. They need to fill those seats because they're doing good stuff, you know, PHP, JavaScript, jQuery, SAS, you know, working in a CMS, that type of stuff. They just all this, you know the job. Do it. Check it out. We'll put a link to this particular job and the job board in general in the show notes. Anyway, that's it.
All right. Well, thank you. And be sure to subscribe to this and your podcatcher of choice. Give it stars and subscribe to Code Newbie. It's really well done. I was admiring it this week. It's better quality than ours. But don't tell anyone. Okay. So thanks everybody for listening. And be sure. Anyway, Chris, you got anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.